Indiana's new Secretary of State. Indiana not getting its fair share of the COVID-19 vaccine, plus changes to the Emergency Powers Bill, and more on Indiana Week in Review, the week ending March 19th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Republican State Representative Holly Sullivan became Indiana's new Secretary of State, sworn in Tuesday after the governor picked her to replace retiring Secretary Connie Lawson. Governor Eric Holcomb says Sullivan was at the top of his list to serve as the state's new Secretary of State. He lauds her legislative experience. Sullivan served in the General Assembly since 2014. Her private sector experience, the Evansville native has an engineering background, and her commitment to her community.
The way you lean into helping women develop and steering youth in the community.
Sullivan was asked several questions by reporters about her stance on election issues. She largely deflected, saying her top priority is to safeguard Indiana's record of free, fair, and secure elections.
Ensure that Hoosiers of all backgrounds are encouraged to turn out, but more importantly, that they have confidence that each of their votes will count.
The Indiana Democratic Party criticized Sullivan for refusing to say, in response to a question, that the 2020 presidential election was legitimate. Is Holly Sullivan a good choice for Secretary of State? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Joey Fox. John Schwannes, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, is Holly Sullivan a good choice?
You know, I really didn't have a strong opinion of one way or the other. She's not been very visible in this part of the state. But I was very disturbed when I heard her press conference, or whatever you want to call the announcement that occurred, that not only did she perpetuate the lie that Mike Braun and Todd Rokita are putting out there that somehow Joe Biden is not the duly elected president. The other thing that concerned me is that she wanted to perpetuate Indiana's outstanding record in the terms of elections, okay? We're in the bottom 10 of the 50 states in turnout, and we're there in large part because of A, gerrymandering, and B, the kind of Jim Crow laws that the Republican-dominated legislature has adopted. They don't by themselves take away the votes of masses of people, but individually they take percentages out of it. You can't vote by mail. They make it difficult to vote early in an urban area. You have to have an excuse for absentees. You have to present ID even though they've never had a documented case of fraud at the polls in Indiana. I would have thought that somebody who's going to be the top election official for the state could have been a little bit more bipartisan in her approach and said, look, we had a fair election here. We have a new president. I'm going to do my best to make it possible for as many Hoosiers as want to vote. And she didn't do that. And that's kind of disturbing.
And I think that's a heck of a set of accusations against the Republican Party and leadership.
When we
have just come out of what was the highest turnout election since,
1994? And we were 10% below the national average.
92. So when you have competitive races, when you have issues that people really care about, people turn out to vote. Holly Sullivan's a great choice. She is a committed engineer. She knows how to do processes. That's going to be a great asset in that office. And she said, just as Connie Lawson and Republican leaders in that office have said for a long time, we want it to be really easy to vote and really hard to cheat. And I think Ann, you can laugh if you want.
It's not true.
But it is true.
It is not
true. It absolutely is true.
That's
and
why
it's demonstrated.
Our turnout is as low as it
well,
is.
Okay. If we're going to just argue and yell over each other, that's one option. It is an option, right?
Mm-hmm.
We do enjoy that. No, but we cannot have a situation where Republicans are being accused by the Democrats on this show and from the state party of Jim Crow laws. That is completely offensive to what we're trying to do.
It is offensive
and to
voters.
And to the record of
it's
good election leadership in the state for a long time.
It's not what I'm objection to.
Does Holly Sullivan make sense as the new Secretary of State?
Yeah.
Presumably who can be in that office for the next almost...
Sure.
I think
there are two questions maybe here that need to be asked. One is, does she make sense on paper as a good candidate? And yes, she checks all the boxes. She's somebody who has had a long tenure in the General Assembly. She, you know, is from a part of the state that gives the party some geographic representation. In other words, not from Indianapolis. The engineering background seems to be a popular thing these days in terms of process, approaching problems in a methodical way. Yeah. So you look at all of those sorts of things. And yes, she was an officer in the state for the state committee in the Republican Party, so she's familiar to a lot of people already throughout the state. All of that. The second question, as I say, is how did she handle her debut in terms of some of the questions that were asked? And maybe that was not as stellar in terms of maybe not anticipating that there would be those kinds of questions. Because in some ways, her answers actually put her at odds with leadership the Speaker of the House in her own chamber and the Senate President Pro Tem, who have effectively said that Joe Biden was elected in a proper manner, in a proper election. So maybe she would want a mulligan on her coming out party, but if you ask the two questions, did she make sense? Yes. Would she maybe answer a few questions differently in hindsight? Yes to that, too.
She doesn't have the kind of experience in running elections that certainly her predecessor had, Connie Lawson. But does that really matter in that office that much?
I think at her position, probably not as much. Obviously, if you're more working directly in the Indiana Election Division, you need to be more on top of how every process works, every form and ballot instructions and things like that. But at her level, I think she'll probably do fine. And she's worked on some elections bills, so she has some experience in there. I do agree with John that she probably didn't handle the policy questions she was given very well at all.
Well, Indiana has begun to lag other states in getting people vaccinated for COVID-19. And officials say that's in part because the state isn't getting as many doses. Neighboring states have begun to open vaccine eligibility to all age groups. Indiana this week opened it to those age 45 and older. State Health Commissioner Dr. Chris Box says the state is working to open eligibility to all by May 1st, the target date set by the Biden administration.
Whether we have vaccine available to everyone who is eligible, though, depends on our supply of vaccine.
According to the CDC, only 6 states have received fewer doses per 100,000 people. Indiana is 17th in the country in population. But Box says the federal government has indicated things should be looking up soon.
We will all be receiving large amounts of vaccine by the last week of March and into April.
Governor Eric Holcomb says he'll deliver a statewide address Tuesday, charting a path for the state out of the pandemic. Here we go. Joey Fox, does Indiana have a legitimate gripe with the Biden administration?
I think so. I think what has happened here, I think what Dr. Box alluded to in the press conference, is we're being punished for our own success at getting the vaccine that we're being given out and getting it in arms. What you're seeing in a lot of these other states where they're lagging behind in actually getting their available shots into people's arms is the federal government and FEMA are then making these massive allotments for these big these big super sites to try and get the numbers back up. And that's where a lot of this vaccine is going in states that aren't doing as well as we are. So in some ways, we're being punished for our success at this. But I think as Dr. Box alluded to as well, I think that problem now with so much production running around the country and all three vaccines, maybe more, over time, I expect this to be corrected fairly soon.
Yeah, we heard from Dr. Box this week that the federal government is telling states to expect a lot more doses regularly starting in a couple of weeks. So is this really a moot point pretty soon, hopefully?
I think so. The president promised 100 million vaccinations within the first 100 days. He's already exceeded that. And so his obvious emphasis is on dealing with this pandemic, not sweeping it under the rug, and getting the vaccines out as quickly as possible. So I think it's a short-term problem that will be resolved pretty quickly.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Icemiller email and text alerts. This week's question, should Indiana open vaccine eligibility to all Hoosiers age 16 and older within the next 2 weeks like neighboring states are doing? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, we asked whether Todd Rokita should do paid consulting work for private companies while serving as attorney general. Just 4% of you say yes. That might be the Rokita family. 96% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, a Senate committee this week dramatically scaled back a plan to restrict the governor's emergency powers used extensively during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Senate's original proposal would have blocked the governor from declaring a public emergency for more than 60 days. The language approved Thursday allows the Legislative Council, a panel of legislative leaders, to call the General Assembly into a special session during an emergency. Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray says the bill also creates a new advisory group of lawmakers to act as a go-between for the legislature and the governor's office.
This was largely be done as a kind of a conduit for conversations and data and information to pass between the two branches of government.
The measure also empowers the legislature to play a bigger role in spending federal stimulus money. There are still concerns the legislation is unconstitutional. Bray says he hopes it doesn't go to court. John Schwanes, is this the compromise we all kind of expected might be coming all along?
I think we were all expecting some sort of measure that was not nearly as strident or as drastic as some of those that we saw coming out of the gate. I think it certainly is much more of a middle ground approach. That doesn't mean, though, that it's any more constitutional. And I'm not a lawyer, but on lawmakers, plug for the other show, on many of these same television stations, we did have former Justice Frank Sullivan of the Indiana Supreme Court, who is a lawyer and has better credentials than I, who said that if you read the Indiana Constitution and you look at the statute as written, in terms of the ability of the legislative branch to call itself back into session, that's problematic. Now, it's not a problem unless somebody challenges it, and I don't know, does somebody challenge it? That's the bigger question.
Yeah, that's a really good question that we've been kind of talking about over the last day or so amongst ourselves. But, Nikki, if you're Governor Holcomb, and let's say this does become law and somehow is found constitutional, are you that upset with the bill as written right now?
Well, I mean, he has made an issue in recent weeks about the constitutionality. So I think he, has to stand up for that in a separation of powers, conversation. He has to think about the future governors and whether they're getting put in a box. I mean, compared to some of the other things they were discussing, it's not all that hateful. But, he has to look.
Boy, that's, talk about damning with faith. Well, that's a
standard. I watched that committee hearing, too, Nikki. We asked Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray right after that committee hearing yesterday. Nikki and I asked him, is this going to have to go to court? And his answer was, I hope not.
Well, there's no way it doesn't go to court because it's the Constitution says the governor calls, period. It doesn't say the legislative council, the legislative leadership. It says the governor. And, I understand the legislature, at least some of the Republicans in the legislature, are angry about the pandemic. All of us would rather it didn't happen, but they're taking their anger out on the governor, who's trying to do, frankly, the best that he can do within the confines of his right-wing party and a pandemic that threatens the economy. And to try to penalize him for something over which he had no control is ridiculous, and this will be unconstitutional.
The legislature all along has said, at the very minimum, they want to have more of a voice if something like this were ever to happen again, a wide-scale emergency when they're not in session. Is the fact that this relatively tame solution to doing that might be unconstitutional show how tough a needle that is to thread?
Of course this is a tough needle, right? When you're arguing executive authority and legislative oversight, it's always going to be that way. I would encourage people to keep in mind that in the legislative process, you really have two things going on. You have a political process and you have a policymaking process. Sometimes those are the same thing and oftentimes they're not. I think you have been watching up to this point a largely political process play out where members from around the state, I'm clearly stuck in the kind of Indianapolis news bubble. Nikki's not, right? And some of the rest of us. This is viewed and the governor's actions are viewed very differently in different parts of the state. And I think you're seeing the people's representatives bring that perspective back. And to Ann's point, I think some of them are angry on how this has been handled and want to have more influence in the future. now. I think you're starting to see the dialing in of getting this closer to, you know, a true policy answer that I don't think the bill's done yet, though.
They can vote for it, and it'll be unconstitutional, and they'll have done something, and it won't have any impact.
Yeah, got to do something.
Just add, other states have done other things. If you look at it, if you really are bored, go to a website. You can see them all at National Council of State Legislature, Conference of State Legislatures. And maybe a way around this, and I'm not suggesting something be done in conference committees, not my place to say, but a legislative council in some places is the can provide the approval. And that means they don't have to come back into session if they already have a legislative council that's already appointed and could at least weigh in. That's what other states have done.
Yes, something to the effect of, I think Senator Karen Tallien mentioned this in the committee yesterday, which was we should be changing the emergency powers statute, which you can do because it's the legislature that gave the power, the governor all this
no
power in the first
ever
place.
Asked for it in the first
right.
place.
Right. So Indiana legislative leaders say they want to end the 2021 session more than a week early, and they plan to take the unusual step of moving up their deadlines to do so. State law says the General Assembly has until April 29th to finish its work, but Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray says lawmakers hope to wrap up by April 21st.
It's more efficient, saves the state money if we're not here the a week. And just generally speaking, if we get our business done, I think we get back home, and most Hoosiers would appreciate that.
Lawmakers often try to end session early, but they almost never move up other deadlines to do so, ones that say when bills must move out of committees and pass their second chambers. House Speaker Todd Houston says the legislature may also move those dates up a week.
It's deadlines for actions, and I think that's the one thing we're just trying to make sure of.
Lawmakers must still pass a new state budget and likely decide how to spend $3 billion in new federal COVID-19 relief funds. Nikki Kelly, in a session that is addressing in part a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic, is getting done a week early something to be happy about?
I don't know. I mean, the fact is you've got two Republican supermajorities, so if they iron out all the big bills before conference committee, you don't need as much time for that final negotiation as you would if you had Democrats. Now, the House did not seem as exercised about getting out early, maybe a few days, but not necessarily a whole week. And yes, the Senate did move their deadlines, but they can move them back the next day. So I don't see it as that different than what they've done every time for recent years. They've always gotten done 3 or 4 or 5 days early. And I think they want to bank some time for the inevitable special session later in the year for redistricting.
John Schwanis, both Bray and Houston referenced to that point. I think Houston was the one who referenced, you know they're going to have to come back at some point later in 2021 to redraw the district lines, which can't happen during the regular session because the Census Bureau work has been so delayed for obvious reasons because of the pandemic principally. But they cite the cost to taxpayers. Do taxpayers care that much about this particular cost?
They may think they do. I think the best answer here is the one Joey gave a minute ago. There's the political side of this equation and the policy and practical side of the equation. When you talk about saving pennies, basically, is what this comes down to, in the scheme of a $36 billion biennial budget, I'm not saying it's chump change, but it's not going to allow them to build a new swine barn, you know, and needn't worry.
Doing that with cash.
Anyway. Doing that with cash anyway. So it's more show, I think, clearly on to Joey's point, this is the politics side. Be careful what you wish for, because yes, they do often end early, but think once those are locked in, those deadlines, think how frantic those final hours can be. And it wasn't too many years ago when we had what was known as the killing fields and a lot of very important legislation that a lot of people wanted to see pass and enjoyed broad support died simply for lack of time. So.
Those died on a regular deadline night. These, they can move at any time.
But a deadline becomes, well.
Yeah. Joey, let me ask you this. If you were to predict, are they going to get done a week early?
I don't think it'll be a full week. I think they may get a few days. I think the interesting thing about this is because only the Senate kind of declared itself to be done with their committees earlier. I mean, if you're the House of Representatives right now, don't you say, oh, okay, right? You know, might enjoy this extra week of getting my stuff done. I think the power dynamics are just interesting here, and see where it goes. But to Nikki's point, you can move them. You can also move them right back if we're not making enough progress.
Do you think they're going to get done a week early?
Not if they're doing what they should do. I mean, we've got the stimulus package coming, and a lot of that requires legislation. I mean, you've got, or unless they're going to let the governor spend it all without any input from the legislature.
They seem pretty adamant that they didn't want that to happen.
Well, that's what I thought too. And you've got billions of dollars for transit, for infants and young children, for education, and no input from the legislature. And I understand that the census is completely screwed up on the Trump watch. I got that. But that doesn't address the question of how they're going to do redistricting. And they're not even discussing that. And on top of that, if they're going to redistrict as late as they're going to redistrict, they have to change the deadlines on some of that. Not on all of them. Some of them are constitutional. Yeah. And they're not dealing with any of those issues. Not any of them.
At least not yet. We're still waiting on that bill to change the law about redistricting. Guess we'll see it at some
point.
That's
what the budget is for, Brandon.
Now, that's what I said. That's what I said. And they said they didn't want to put it in the budget. Well, six referees who were supposed to officiate the men's Division I basketball championships in Indiana have been removed this week following a positive COVID-19 test. Only one of the six officials was reported to have actually tested positive, but the NCAA said in a statement that the other five interacted with the individual for a prolonged amount of time and must quarantine. The risk of exposure makes them unable to participate in the upcoming games. There are four pre-approved replacement officials available for March Madness, but two will not be replaced. This was the first reported COVID-19 case among those who are inside the controlled environment that has been created for March Madness. Joey Fox, we're all obviously excited about the tournament being here in Indiana and the Division II tournament being here in Indiana as well, on the men's side, but is it fair to worry whether all of these tournament games will actually be played?
I think the tournament games will be played. I mean, there's a pandemic going on. You have to be worried a little bit all the time. But not only is it exciting, I just am incredibly proud as a Hoosier and as a citizen of Indianapolis on what we've been able to put together here on just incredibly short timelines, and to the Sports Corp and the Chamber, visiting everybody that's kind of worked on this. It's really been incredible, and it's fun to see downtown alive a little bit again. I'm really excited about it, and I think it's something we should all be really proud of.
I'm going to ask for your predictions on the actual sporting event here in a second, Ann, but do you think that all 68 games, whatever it is, 60-plus games, do you think they'll all actually be played?
I really hope so. I mean, I think they've done an incredible job of trying to make it as safe as you can make it. I mean, there are no guarantees anywhere, but I think they've done a masterful job of isolating and testing and trying to make certain that the players are as safe as they can be. So I hope every single game plays.
Now, in this case, it was, as I referenced in the piece, it was only one person who tested positive, but five who were in close contact and not wearing their masks and everything, because they all went out to
the
dinner.
Yeah, that's the issue,
right? So, but does this almost show how the system is working in a sense?
Yeah, and I mean, they've done 9,100 tests before play kicked off yesterday, and there were only something like 8 positive.
Yeah.
So I think teams are taking it seriously. They're keeping separate. They're spending times in their rooms. I don't think, you know, anyone's going out to hang at the, you know, strip club or anything like that.
Let's hope not.
It's public television.
John, when we look back on this tournament entirely within Indiana, are we going to be proud of the result?
Oh. We'll be proud, absolutely. Nobody can do it the way Indiana can do it. And I think the only danger we run is that we want to do it this way every time. I mean, why do you have to go and have it, you know, east, west, midwest? Let's just do it all here. Bloomington's farther enough south. You know, West Lafayette's far enough north. We could do it all here every year.
It's got my vote. All right. Well, finally, the NCAA Division I men's basketball tournament is underway here in Central Indiana. Games started yesterday. They're being played today and so on. So, panel, I want to know who you've got winning this year's Big Dance. And, Delaney, we will start with you.
I wish I could say I had an Indiana team.
Well, Purdue.
But I don't. I know, but I don't think
they're
going to
You're an IU grad.
I'm going with Gonzaga.
The number one overall seed. Hard to argue with that. Joey Fox.
Baylor.
Baylor, that's an interesting pick.
Gonzaga, certainly on paper, but I'd love to see a Big Ten team do well. Even that one that starts with P.
I'm with you.
All right.
Pushing them all to the Sweet 16. It's just after that.
Then that's where you're loyal. Okay.
I'm going to go with Gonzaga, too, and I believe they might tie IU's perfect season.
Well, then I don't. I'm changing my answer. That's then. Right. I'm changing
we
my answer.
That's right.
We don't want that.
She takes it back.
That's right. She now wants Purdue. She wants
another
Purdue.
First on this show. And Ann Delaney takes it back. I don't know.
Well, I'd love to be able to pick my Missouri Tigers. I expect them to get out of the first round and no farther against Gonzaga, quite frankly. But I've got my home state, at least, flying Illini of the University of Illinois. I asked Mike O'Brien, a regular panelist as well. He's also got the Illini, as does Governor Holcomb on his bracket. We'll see. The Illini, I think, were cruising to victory before we started taping in their first-round game today. But that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Joey Fox, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, wear a mask, and get a vaccine if you can. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.